Welcome and thank you for joining us here today at the Saal Glitch. The next talk will be by Renske Romans and Enrico Sandro Colizzi and about biological evolution, writing, rewriting, and breaking the program of life. Please give a very warm applause. The stage is yours.
All right. Is this on? Yeah, awesome. Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for coming to our talk. My name is Renske, and this is Sandro. And we are theoretical biologists working on evolution. And today we would like to share with you our way of thinking about evolution, which we think is quite powerful. And we use this specifically to explain how evolution creates the rules for life. And hopefully by the end of the talk, it will be clear what we mean by that. So in this talk, we will share our views, obviously, but if nothing else, we hope that you come away with some cool new biology factoids to share over the dinner table, and there will be badly drawn pigeons, so it's worth it already. So you just need to step out of the conference center into the park to realize how incredibly diverse life is. There's all kinds of plants, animals, fungi. There's, at the moment, about 10 million species of the big stuff that you can see, and even millions more of the small stuff, the bacteria, the slime molds, and so on. So all this diversity was created by evolution. And these inconceivable numbers, I'm just not just throwing at you, but just to give you a sense of how incredibly creative this process is. This process has been going on uninterruptedly for 4 billion years, from the origin of life to the first cells that made it into this primordial soup, to the invention of eating sunlight through photosynthesis, the first cells with this big nucleus to house all the DNA, to the fungi, the plants, the animals, actually pretty late along the Earth's history, finally to end up at the beautiful creatures that we see at the conference today. Throughout all of this, evolution has had to overcome a number of minor obstacles, like the late heavy bombardment, just this incredible rain of meteorites throughout, a bunch of ice ages turning the Earth into a snowball, a few volcano eruptions polluting the air and the water and covering the Earth in darkness for a few millennia, right up to today's major event, which is us. And so throughout all these extinctions, these mass events where a lot of stuff died, evolution still manages to carry on with the few species and create this enormous diversity anew. So those are the facts, these are the observations that we need to explain. But how does the theory of evolution actually work?
Well, in the theory of evolution, in the explanation we give to understand how organisms change over time, what we typically do is we make our life slightly simpler. We say, let's imagine there is a population of organisms. And so here are some badly drawn pigeons. They are some birds. They come into perhaps an island in which there are no birds. And once they're there, they start eating the resources. Now, these birds can eat the food there. They grow, multiply, produce offspring. But after some time, a random mutation appears. And I'm indicating this in the second pane with the yellow beak. Now, this pigeon with a yellow beak is better than the others at eating food, perhaps because it's better able to digest it, or perhaps because it's better able to extract energy from it. Whatever the case, this pigeon starts growing, starts multiplying faster than the rest of the population. And so because of this, over the course of many generations, the population will be slowly replaced by pigeons that have, well, in this cartoon case, a yellow beak, until the point in which all you are left with is a population with yellow beaks. So To recap the story, we have random mutations arising. These mutations are inherited through generations, and selection, provided by the environment, selects, so decides, which traits, which variants are carried on over the course of the generations. Okay, so how does this theory work? Well, the theory of evolution by natural selection was first proposed by Charles Darwin, and Darwin himself worked a lot to show that his theory held water. One of his most famous examples comes from the finches during his trip in the Galapagos Islands, where he observed that these finches had different species, had different beak sizes. And so these different beak sizes were adapted, were suited to eating different types of food, seeds, fruits, etc. And so we can imagine then, the theory goes, that once the original bird, the original finch, arrived to the Galapagos, over time, of course this bird had a beak to begin with, over time, by mutations, the beak of this bird changed in size. And so the theory works quite well to explain how these small changes, small beak, big beak, come about. But what about the long term? Well, if we go far back in time, oh, and so I forgot to mention, these changes in beak took about 1 million years to happen. This is short timescale for evolution. What about the long timescale? What if we wind back the tape of life of a few hundred million years? Well, back then, there were animals already, but no animal had a beak. And so, in fact, there weren't even birds around. And so somewhere along the line of descent of these animals, at some point, a beak had to be created. And once it was created, it could be selected to become larger or smaller to adapt to the food. So here we don't care particularly about birds. Birds are super cool. But what we care about is making a theory that can account for these very long timescales. So Darwin's theory of evolution works well for small million years timescales because it explains well how small changes happen. But it doesn't do very well when it comes to explaining how big changes, how novelty comes about. In other words, how the rules of life are written in the first place.
So why do we need this big theory? Well, we are fundamentally interested in this incredibly diverse life. We think it's beautiful. We cannot stop wondering about it. But there's also a point to it. Because, for instance, many modern medical challenges are fundamentally evolutionary in nature. We've all experienced it pretty recently, that viruses evolve incredibly rapidly, bringing the long time scales actually scarily close to us, causing pandemics that never seem to end. We get continually outsmarted by bacteria who keep evolving resistance to the antibiotics that we throw at it. And this is becoming an incredibly large problem. And finally, we are currently in the middle of a mass extinction event, the likes of which we've barely seen before, that is human-caused. And we do not quite understand how this will upset the ecological and evolutionary trajectory of ecosystems. Finally, in this era where people are searching for generative AIs, it may be useful to have a good understanding of an entirely different process that is truly creative, both its benefits and perhaps its detriments. So how does novelty evolve? Where does new stuff come from over evolutionary time? And so for this, we'll just take the feather. What is a feather? What does it do? Well, if you put a feather in the wing of a bird, it helps to get that creature to fly. It has the excellent properties, it works really well, to the point of being annoying. And so in today's world, we can say feathers are for flight. But before there were birds, feathers already existed. And you get reconstructions like this of this dinosaur-looking creature that is covered in feathers, but certainly didn't fly. And so the current theory is that feathers evolved for thermoregulation to keep dinosaurs warm during the frigid Jurassic winters. Some people propose that these feathers may also have been colorful in some species for better attracting a mate. And so feathers went from being excellent at keeping the dinosaurs warm to being repurposed for flight in the context of the bird wing.
Okay, so all this was to give a couple of motivating examples about how evolution writes rules and how it rewrites them. Like in the case of feathers, it shifts the context in which the feather is used to give it a completely new function. So before we can make a theory, I have to give you just a slightly bit more detail about what these rules are like, how they are encoded in biological systems, and how they're used. So we all know that instructions are stored in the DNA. The DNA is a long molecule, and it's subdivided into functional units called genes. And genes code for proteins. Proteins are, in a sense, the cellular hardware of the cell, and you can think of them like little logic circuits. Proteins do all kinds of things in the cell. They can give structural support to the cell, giving it a shape. They can carry out metabolic functions, so they can carry out reactions for a cell's metabolism. They can be exchanged between cells, so that cells can communicate with each other. But all these, in our view, are forms of computation. So what do we mean by this? Well, in this example, you see two proteins, protein 1 and protein 2, and as it happens frequently with proteins, proteins can stick to each other by being somewhat complementary in shape. And in this case, only when these two proteins come together, this protein complex is functional for doing something. Well, doesn't this look like a lot like a logical AND gate? And so, in this sense, proteins do computation. Of course, there aren't just two proteins in a cell, there's several millions, and so proteins organize themselves and run this computation in parallel, and we can depict them as forming massive networks. It is the running and the computation of these networks that makes a cell. And then, of course, multiple cells come together in organs, and organs are these different functional units that together form an organism. In this case, our pretty elephant. And we are not done here. Populations of different species come together and interact to form ecosystems. So to recap, the rules for computing an organism are stored in the DNA, and they are executed through all these levels of organization to compute life as we know it. Okay, so now we have these rules. How can we make a theory of evolution with this? Well, when a mutation happens in the DNA, what happens is that the protein that is encoded by that part of DNA can malfunction because it doesn't have the same sequence and doesn't have the same information as before. And so because of this, then the module of the network in which this protein works can malfunction, and so on through the cell and through the organism. So this malfunction can percolate up to making our elephant very sick. This is a genetic disease. But also, we have seen that proteins and groups of protein do this kind of computations, and so modules of these proteins can be shuffled around in different parts of the networks. And so by doing this, we change the context in which these groups, these proteins are working, and by doing this, we can change the function. And so, you know, you're all familiar with this when it comes to an example like Lego, where the same block can be used to be part of a dinosaur or the helmet of a stormtrooper. And of course, this example is analogous to the feather that Renske showed you earlier, and in which a change in context brought about a new function.
All right, so with all of this in place, let's ask some big questions from our big evolutionary theory. Sandro and I, for the last few years, have been working on the origin of animals. Because if you rewind the clock 500 million years, there are no animals on this planet. So within 500 million years, all this incredible diversity of animal life has had to emerge. And so we thought, if we want to understand how evolution generated all this diversity, we have to go back to the root where evolution constructed the rules for animal life. And so, because we are computational biologists, we make computer models of the origin of multicellularity. Because if we go back to those 500 million years, what we will find is a critter that is not yet an animal, but is about to become one. And this critter is consisting of only a single cell that lives autonomously, that is able to reproduce, survive all kinds of threats, and find resources all on its own. So how does this autonomous cell become part of a collective and give up its autonomy? So this is, to introduce you to the simulation that we make, consider this two-dimensional arena where in this little red speck we have a cell. As you can see, this cell has to find some resources for its survival. And we place those resources right at the left. And these resources, we imagine, secrete some chemical into this gradient that the cell can sniff and use to find its way to these resources. If you want to know how the cell model works specifically, come talk to us after the presentation and we're happy to show you more on how you can do this yourself. But for now, what we will see is that while we can really clearly see where the cell is going, that this nice reddish, orange, yellow gradient is very clear to us, but at the spatial scale of the cell, this is a different matter, because the cell can only sniff directly around it. And at that scale, the gradient is actually really shallow, so the direction isn't really clear. And you see all these little white dots? That's noise. There is no signal there. And so actually, the poor cell will make a lot of mistakes. So if you run the simulation, you see that the cell is moving, it's going in the direction where it thinks it should go, but you can keep running this for ages and the cell will never get there. Now, we can take a number of these cells and make them stick together. Each of these cells in the cluster is as terrible as the original cell at identifying where it has to go. But we also make them stick to each other, and so they want to stay together. As a consequence of this, while each individual cell is still meandering around and swirling, the group as a whole migrates in a straight line to the resources. And this is because each individual cell may make an error and go off in the wrong direction, but somewhere else in the cluster, there's a cell making the opposite error. And so these mistakes average out and cancel out to only leave the right direction of motion. And so this means that we have a new rule that exists only at the group level. This new rule is that a group will migrate through a shallow gradient to the resources. And this rule did not exist, as we saw, for the single cell.
Okay, so our cells so far were quite simple. All they could do was to move around, sniff locally this gradient, and try to follow it. But we also showed you earlier that cells inside do all kinds of calculations to do all kinds of behaviors. So we can just program that into our cells. And so this work is being carried out by our PhD students, Alexandre Fernandez. And in this model, what we do is, well, we saw earlier, that the kind of calculations that happen inside a cell are organized in terms of networks. And so we give these each cell a network, and these networks perform all kinds of operations that tell a cell whether it wants to move towards food or whether it wants to divide. And when it divides, it produces offspring. And we also let the cells determine by themselves, through this network, how much they want to stick to other cells. And now we run evolutionary simulations with this model. And so every time a cell divides, we're going to change randomly some of the parameters of this network. And after a long time spent in the cluster calculating this, we are showing you what has evolved. OK, just to understand the next video, what you're seeing here is a blob made of a bunch of cells. And and these cells are red when they are migrating towards food. Food are the little brown circles that you see there. And cells get to food, and they eat. Sometimes you see blue cells. I'll show them in a sec. And these cells are cells that are about to divide. Ready? We go. Our multicellular creature moves towards food, eats it, and bam, it starts creating these little spores that form new multicellular clusters that then go on to eat and colonize other food patches. And then this multicellular life cycle repeats over and over again. OK, so at this point, there's something odd happening, because all the story that I told you on how to make this model, what we programmed in the computer, were just things and events and computations happening inside the cell. But the story that comes out after evolution is a story of multicellular organisms that go, that eat food, and then replicate and reproduce as multicellular organisms. So how is this going on? Well, the cells have evolved a program in which cells migrate towards food, eat the food, and once they have eaten, they turn blue, so they divide. And when they do that, they stop sticking to each other and get detached from the cluster. And this allows them to form new little multicellular organisms that then go on and colonize other cell patches, other food patches. And so what has happened here is that evolution has, in a way, rewritten the rules that we have given by creating a new context, this multicellular cluster. And in this multicellular cluster, being a dividing cell means being a spore. And spores can then go on and colonize and create new multicellular organisms.
So just to recap, we started from an old theory of evolution by mutation and selection, and made a new theory by including the building blocks and viewing these as a set of instructions for building an organism. And evolution can write, as we've seen, new rules and can rewrite old rules and place them in a new context to do something new. And so we like to think of evolution as a bit of a hacker, but a hacker without a goal, exploiting and abusing existing code and accidentally constructing traits that are entirely new. So before we conclude this, we just wanted to throw one last bit of biology at you, because have you heard of zombie ants? These are ants that are infected by a fungus, which makes them abandon the nest, climb up a plant, and clamp down with their jaws on the vein of a leaf. There, the ant will stay and die while the fungus develops into these beautiful fruiting bodies, where it and then release the spores that fall onto the forest floor, ready to infect the next ants. Isn't life beautiful? So what is going on here? We don't think this is quite a zombie ant, but it is a hacked ant. The fungus is literally injecting the chemical instructions that take over the hardware of the ant and override its behavioral rules to provide it with a very specific set of new behaviors that benefit the fungus, but not so much the ant. So through evolution, the fungus has found a way to break the rules of the ant.
Okay, we're at the end. We're still, as you can see, quite far from evolving birds, elephants, ants. But we can already see these patterns of rule writing and rewriting in our simulations. And so we do wonder how, if some of these principles of evolutionary creativity that we've shown you today can be useful to build truly generative and creative artificial intelligence. But if there is just one message that we'd like you to take home, is this. Evolution is a creative force that, by shuffling around very simple building blocks, writes, rewrites, and breaks the rules of life and is never quite finished.
We'll take questions.
Thank you so much for this wonderful talk. We have time for some questions. If you don't wish to participate in the Q&A, we kindly ask you to leave the room quietly. The first question, I think, was coming from mic number 3. 2.
Hey, I've been debating this zombie ants up and down with my biology friend. I'm not a trained biologist. And we were wondering, or I was wondering, how such a complex pattern of action could be implemented by something so simple as a fungus. And my biology friend told me that the action patterns probably already exist in the ant brain, and the fungus only activates them. Do you have an opinion on this? Is that plausible, or does the fungus actually create new behavior in the ant that didn't exist beforehand?
Luego, do you?
Go okay, ahead.
Yes. So, as a first nitpick, a fungus is not simple. A fungus is a very, very complex organism. But back to your point, in a sense, yes, what a fungus is telling the ant to do is to move, which is something that an ant walk around, which is something an ant can do, climb a plant, which an ant can totally do, and then clamp with its jaw to a leaf, which is something that the ant can already do. But the way the ant normally does this behavior is for, which it already can do, is for a completely different goal, which is the survival of the nest and so foraging, etc. So what the fungus has to do is to force the ant to take these actions that it can already do and make the ant focus only on these specific actions at a particular timing. So in this sense, this is how the fungus is hijacking what an ant can do. It's hijacking a specific course of actions for an ant, rather than completely inventing new actions that an ant couldn't do before.
It's still quite remarkable, right? Because it's quite a determined sequence. And so the fungus has to time this quite well. It clamps on the vein of a leaf. So how does it know that there is a leaf? These are super interesting questions still. Like, it is quite marvelous.
Thanks.
The next questions are from microphone number 3.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for your talk. I have a question about the validation of your computational model. So have you validated the simulation somehow with how evolution really developed? And is that even possible in any way?
So a direct validation is quite tricky because indeed we can't go back in time and know what was out there. One thing that we do is to make the model bio-inspired. So there are species that are currently living that are close relatives to animals living today. And so they exhibit certain behaviors like directional migration, so they can do this chemotaxis. We know that they can in fact stick to each other. And they have, some of them, a multicellular life cycle that looks quite like this. So through these comparison to species that we know today is how we try to validate the model. But we try to start from first principles.
Thanks.
Microphone number 1.
Thank you. My question goes in probably also comment. You thought about at the end, how can we use the ideas of trial and error of the evolution, maybe also in the cyber world. And so for me, probably one prerequisite would be good selection ideas. But the other level, I think, is time. And there I'm more skeptical. So when you look at the real evolution in biological life, I think the time and quantity that you bring out something meaningful out of trial and error is something we probably won't see in our life, even if we have very big machines.
So, well, do you want to take it?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, you take it.
I totally agree with this. And I think for many, as far as I understand it, like there's already all kinds of algorithms to speed up learning, for instance. I think it's less about the trial and error of evolution, but the way it repurposes modules in a new context that creates the novelty. So it's less about the sort of microscopic way of proceeding with finding new solutions, and more the way in which novelty is created, which is, we think, really old stuff, new context, and then building from there. It's this iterative process of we use what's already here, and then we find a new context in which that takes on new meaning.
So to add maybe half a word to this, one thing that we are learning how to do is to make evolution evolve its ability to evolve faster. This is a thing that we see in real life example. For example, bacteria evolve resistance to antibiotics at a way faster rate that we were thinking it was even possible. An example of this is one of the last antibiotics that was released in the market. They later discovered that a bacterium had evolved a resistance before the antibiotic was already released in the market. So evolution works incredibly fast, and we are, in a way, still learning how to make it go faster also in the computer.
Yes, and please use this time for questions. If you have a comment, please find our speakers afterwards and discuss. The next question is coming from microphone number 4.
First of all, thanks for the talk. And my question is, have you tried the simulation with a rival bacterium or some predators, mayhaps?
We tried this in the beginning, I think. Things get complicated really quickly. We went back to the drawing board, made this super simple model because we just wanted ourselves to understand what was going on. But I think it would be really interesting to now introduce competitors again, yes.
Okay. Not only it would be very interesting and it would make the model more interesting and also more complex, but there is also a very important counterpart. There are experiments that show that you can, evolutionary experiments, so people that are in the lab and then sit there looking at evolution happening, showing that predators create an evolutionary pressure that make cells stick together more. So that is a way to create multicellularity.
Thank you.
The next question off of microphone number 1.
First question. So is it known that the multicellular life evolved separately in each kingdom? And the other question is, do you guys have any thoughts on the maximum power principle?
So the count for independent evolutionary events for multicellularity stands at 48 at the moment and still counting. So actually it happened many more times than we actually thought. And yes, plants, fungi, and animals evolved multicellularity completely independently. And I have no idea what the last term you said was. So if you can explain, that would be great.
Maximum power principle by Lotka and Udine or whatever. I'll ask you after.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Okay.
Yes, please, one question per mic. If you have two questions, join again in the queue. The next question is from number 3.
All right. Crabs. These things, I mean, related to that question, they seem to evolve again and again independently. So two questions. Do you think this maybe hints that this life force hacker is somehow exploiting some structures, such as like walking sideways is very useful? And do you know other funny examples like crabs?
There's many such cases. But indeed, there's two ways to look at this. So there's the lower level way, where we think that crabs may have evolved multiple times because there is an underlying molecular module that allows this to emerge again and again, because animals do have a shared evolutionary history that can be exploited. And indeed, the walking sideways might just be a fantastic idea. But I think there's multiple cases like this. If you look at plants, leaves evolved multiple times, roots evolved multiple times. There is a strong evolutionary pattern that the same idea evolves multiple times independently.
Indeed, when it comes to things like wings for flying and eyes for seeing, it's easy to see why they would evolve repeatedly and independently many times. When it comes to crabs, it's kind of strange, but there is probably some useful reason, or maybe, as Lenske says, some underlying module that can be shifted around in this larger context that is easy to shuffle.
Microphone number two.
When talking about organic life, there's a trend of in history of always using the newest technology with comparing it to a cleaned out pipe organ, with comparing it to a locomotive, a car, and now there are computers. And evolution is both based in, for example, machine learning to create better learning programs, and it's also the other way around, where you started the presentation with describing some proteins as logic gates. Do you think computers are the perfect analogy, or do you think we will evolve technologically even further with an even better analogy for nature?
I think it's so. In my opinion, these are metaphors, and so they are useful as long as they are useful. I think in this case, it makes it so thinking of life in these terms, which is quite computational, quite information processing based. This is useful. It makes you pull together disparate examples, things that at first sight don't look they are the same phenomenon, and allows you to make a theory that unifies a bunch of these different phenomena. The next technological innovation will be carried by some kind of societal changing and also change in way of thinking. And so people in the next few generations will think in a different way and will use different metaphors and will be able to see the limits of our present-day metaphors.
I would like to add to that this is not a universal view by any means. There's also already all kinds of opinion pieces that will tell you computation is entirely the wrong metaphor. We should ditch the machine metaphor as well. Cells are not machines. They're not computing anything. It's something entirely different. So this is definitely debated. Also, the use value of... And so it's really about the use value of seeing life in this way. Yeah. But we think it's quite... We think it's quite powerful because we can see that using that picture and implementing it in our simulation yields something that to us looks quite lifelike.
Microphone number four.
From your point of view, given the current stage of computational increase and evolution and the stage of research that you can see, how long it will take up to reach a full computational modeling of life? Maybe decades, years, to reach a piece of software that it's a realistic model of life? Because before or later it will happen, but how long?
I think we are not quite there yet. I don't think I can give you an exact time scale, because time scales are these things that if I tell you 50 years, in 10 years something happens, right? But I think there's two things here. So to simulate life, I think the theory for doing that is there, and so it's just a matter of computing power. For making a theory of life, we don't quite need to simulate all life. We just need to simulate enough of it in sufficiently many different cases so that we can get a good understanding of what's happening out there. But if you want the number, 50 years.
I think we have time for one last question.
I should have said 42, right?
42.
Yeah.
Microphone number one, if you can do it short.
Yeah. How far do you think you can take this mechanism of creative evolution in from a microscopic to a maybe more macroscopic scale?
I think we can push this still quite a bit further. In the beginning, we didn't think that we would get this result, but our cells are still so, so simple. And we've shown you just a fraction of the kind of behavior that they can evolve with this small toolkit already. So I am pretty hopeful that we can get to something that has different cell types, maybe a kind of little organ inside the multicellular organism that is there performing a particular function for the group of cells, which I would be really excited about. I think this is feasible.
Again, thank you so much to our speaker for this wonderful talk. Can we have a huge applause?